should the Supreme Court defer to the will of the majority and respect the will of the majority and therefore uphold most democratically enacted laws? Or does the Constitution empower the courts to act as a check on the other branches of government and then to act and act aggressively and act in even an anti-democratic fashion when the majority has overstepped its boundaries? So we've talked a lot about ideas and the power of ideas this weekend, and we've heard about the power of ideas in terms of changing government policy, the power of ideas in terms of influencing the Supreme Court. And so I'm going to continue that theme and talk about the power of ideas on the Supreme Court and legal philosophies and how they have affected some of the biggest Supreme Court cases in U.S. history. So I wanted to read two quotations that sort of set up the themes of what I'm going to talk about. The first comes from a letter written in the year 1920 by Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr. And he writes, and in this letter, I should say, Holmes is talking about his philosophy of judging, what he believes the role of a judge, what the role of a judge should be. And he writes, quote, "If my fellow citizens want to go to hell, I will help them. It's my job." The second quote comes from Chief Justice John Roberts in his 2012 decision upholding the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. This is the Obamacare case, 2012. John Roberts writes, quote, "It is not our job to protect the people from the consequences of their political choices." So in other words, in Obamacare, Roberts might have said, let the people go to hell. You voted for Obama, you get Obamacare. So, you know, at a glance, this is a pair of strange bedfellows. Roberts is this elite conservative legal thinker, and Oliver Wendell Holmes is this progressive era justice who made his name arguing that the courts should defer to the elected branches of government and should uphold most democratically enacted economic regulations, the progressive regulations of the time. So what is a conservative like Roberts doing invoking this progressive era hero, Holmes, in the Obamacare case? Well, the answer is that these men both are proponents, or were in Holmes's case, proponents of the philosophy of judicial restraint or judicial deference. And this is the idea that the Supreme Court and the courts are the least democratic branch of our government, and as a result, they owe extra respect or deference to the elected branches, to the democratically accountable branches. You know, the president elected by the people, Congress elected by the people, state lawmakers, legislatures elected by the people of those states. And so when a constitutional question comes before the Supreme Court dealing one of these democratically enacted statutes, the judges should put the thumb on the scale on the side of the government, on the side of lawmakers, and tip the balance that way. So this is this idea of judicial deference. And although it starts off as a philosophy of the progressives, and Holmes is writing during the progressive era, and the progressives love him. He is a hero to the progressives. He's hugely influential on the New Deal. When the New Deal triumphs at the Supreme Court, 1937, 38, Holmes's views are vindicated, are accepted by the majority, and they're still with us today. But judicial restraint or deference has also become a touchstone of modern conservatives. In the last 40 years, the conservative legal movement has rallied around this call in many ways. And Robert Bork, the late Robert Bork, who was Ronald Reagan, of course, nominated to the Supreme Court and was a federal judge, a very distinguished conservative legal scholar, Bork was a proponent of this Oliver Wendell Holmes-style judicial deference. And in his book, The Tempting of America, Bork wrote, quote, "In wide areas of life, majorities are entitled to rule if they wish, simply because they are majorities." For Bork, that meant the Supreme Court should butt out of those disputes, those wide areas of life, let the majority rule. So this approach, the Holmes-Bork approach, this is what John Roberts invokes in the Obamacare case, the biggest case of his term. Now, obviously, many conservatives were not too happy with that ruling, and of course, libertarians were outraged about it also, because that is one way for judges to approach these questions, but there is another way. And this other way has been associated very closely with the libertarian legal movement, which is what I call it in the book, that's arisen in the last 30 or 40 years. And David mentioned the Institute for Justice. They are pioneers in this work. Manny Klausner, who's here with us, Manny has been a libertarian lawyer fighting these fights. The Cato Institute Center for Constitutional constitutional studies, has been involved in these fights. And what the libertarian legal movement's view is, they say, well, wait a minute, you know, the Constitution is a liberty document. It protects a broad range of individual rights, and it imposes strict limits on government power. And so it therefore is the job of the courts to police the other branches of government, to strike down government overreach. And that, of course, was the view of the legal challengers in the Obamacare case. They lose because Roberts invokes this progressive doctrine of judicial deference. So my book is about the battle between this clash of visions, and that's why I call it the Long War, because it's an intellectual battle that's been going on for a century and a half, and as I say, it's shaped many of the biggest cases in our legal history. We see it in the Progressive Era and the New Deal era, where the question is, what is the government's role in the economy? How much power does Congress have under the Commerce Clause to regulate economic affairs? How much power do the states have? And the progressives and the New Dealers said, well, that power is practically unlimited, and the courts have no business stepping in, and conservative and sort of proto-libertarian judges and lawyers of the time, they wanted the courts to act. And the courts did act against some progressive laws, against some New Deal regulations, but that view ultimately is not triumphant. And we see this intellectual battle continuing throughout the 20th century in the battles over civil rights, voting rights, school desegregation, where once again the question is, should the court act? Should the court act against Democratic majorities on the state level? Does the 14th Amendment empower the courts to strike down overreaching state laws? We heard about that today at lunch, when there was the issue of the 14th Amendment, voting rights, the civil rights movement. And that was once again this question of how much deference is owed to these local officials. And then, of course, it's, as I said, in the Obamacare case, we saw it in recent gun rights cases where District of Columbia versus Heller, McDonald versus City of Chicago, where local authorities said, look, you know, the Second Amendment, that's fine, but we understand the conditions. We got a lot of crime down here. We got a lot of gun violence. And the Supreme Court should not be minding our business, should not be second guessing the gun control regulations that local officials and state officials had come up with. And the libertarian view, and I should say that those really were libertarian cases. The lawyers who argued and won those Second Amendment cases are libertarian lawyers. Clark Neely from the Institute for Justice, Alan Gura, Bob Levy from the Cato Institute, they conceived, litigated, and won those cases, bringing this libertarian philosophy. The Constitution's a liberty document, the Second Amendment's a liberty provision of the Bill of Rights, and it limits the government. So that's the broad theme of the whole book. But what I wanted to do tonight is talk just briefly about two cases where these philosophies are really sort of evident. So the first case that illustrates these theories is called Meyer versus Nebraska. The Supreme Court decides this case in the year 1923. And the backdrop to this case is World War I. America, we're at war with Germany. And the home front, all sorts of really ugly anti-German sentiment pops up. There's jingoistic behavior. And some of this in historical, you know, looking back, is sort of comical. There was a movement to rename the hamburger as the Liberty Sandwich. You know, so some of this we can laugh at, but then there were ugly things that happened too. There's lynchings of German Americans, German immigrants. And in the state of Nebraska, the state legislature passed a law that made it illegal to educate young children in a foreign language, public and private schools. And the target of this legislation was the state's Lutheran parochial schools. German immigrants in the state were sending their kids to Lutheran schools where the teachers and the students were frequently speaking German. So there is a man named Robert Meyer. He's a Bible teacher at this school, teaches the Bible in German to little kids. And he's now a criminal under state law. And he says, this is unconstitutional, this violates my rights, violates the rights of these parents. He takes the case to the state Supreme Court, he loses. The state Supreme Court says the salutary purpose of the law is clear. They saw no problem with it. He takes it to the federal courts, to the Supreme Court, and he wins. And the Supreme Court issues what I think is one of a really resounding libertarian statement in our legal history. It's the opinions by Justice James McReynolds, who's later kind of infamous as one of the Four Horsemen, which is this negative term given to the conservative justices who voted regularly against the New Deal. The liberals at the time called them the Four Horsemen of Reaction. Well, in this case, McReynolds writes this great statement about liberty. He says the word liberty in the 14th Amendment, this is a due process clause, quote, denotes not merely freedom from bodily restraint, but also the right of the individual to contract, to engage in any of the common occupations of life, to marry, establish a home, and bring up children. So you see, Economic liberty is there, liberty of contract, right to work in a common occupation, but also rights of families to marry, to raise children. So, of course, our old friend Justice Holmes is on the Supreme Court at the time, so he dissents in the case. He says that he doesn't see anything in the Constitution that would prevent the state legislature from experimenting on its young citizens in this way. He said, let the majority have its way. That's his view in this case. So, the second case I'll talk about, it's a little more recent, and I think it'd be a little more familiar to probably a lot of you, is called Kelo versus the City of New London. This is a case in 2005, eminent domain property rights case, litigated by the Institute for Justice. And you know, so the backdrop to Kelo is, well, first of all, the constitutional issue is the Fifth Amendment, something called the Takings Clause, which says that the government cannot take public property for a public use unless it pays just compensation. So what's a public use? Well, traditionally, a public use is if the government wants to build a road or a bridge or a tunnel, and you know, some landowners in the way, and they pay them out of the public treasury, and then they build the road. The City of New London, Connecticut, in this case, they had a broader sense of what this power would allow them to do. The Pfizer Pharmaceutical Corporation was building a new research and development facility in New London, and there was this neighborhood right next to it called Fort Trumbull, and this was a lovely working class, a well-tended neighborhood. You know, not a fancy neighborhood, but like a working class neighborhood in good shape. And the city thought, wouldn't it be great if we could just send the bulldozers in, flatten the neighborhood, give the land to private developers, and they will put up a hotel and some restaurants and some upscale amenities, and that would bring in more tax dollars, and that would benefit all of us, the public of New London, and we should be able to do this under the takings power. And I mean, obviously, people who live in this neighborhood didn't think that was a good idea. And there's a woman named Suzette Kelo. She had this little pink house that had a view of the river that she loved, and so she formed the backbone of a local property rights movement that fought back against this government action. The City of New London fought, you know, they fought it out in court, and they end up at the Supreme Court. And the City of New London's argument is, look, what counts as a public use, that's really up to us to decide. That is a question for the legislature, not for the court. Is we say, you know, we know the conditions here, we know what we need. This is an economic revitalization plan, it's in the best interest, and this is really the kind of judgment that the courts have no business getting involved in. Obviously, Suzette Kelo, the Institute for Justice, took a very different view. They said, look, the public use clause has teeth, it means what it says, and this is not a public use, and this goes too far. Many of you are familiar with this case, Ed, but nonetheless, I'm sorry to report that Suzette Kelo loses. The Supreme Court rules for the city in this case. It's a 5-4 decision. The majority opinion is written by Justice John Paul Stevens. He's since retired, but he was the leader of the court's liberal wing at the time. And Stevens writes, quote, our longstanding policy of deference to legislative judgments in this field require the city to win. He said, we cannot second guess the legislature. He said, it is up to lawmakers and not the court to decide, quote, what public needs justify the use of the takings clause. Now that is the classic argument for judicial deference right there. If you have a complaint about what your lawmakers have done, take it to the ballot box, not to the courthouse. That's what he told these people. And their neighborhood is bulldozed as a result of this. It's a highly controversial opinion, obviously. In fact, there was bipartisan outrage against this decision. The NAACP filed a brief in the case on Suzette Kelo's side. There was a real left-right coalition in favor of these homeowners and against this government action. But the Supreme Court saw it differently and invoked this idea of deference to lawmakers. But it was the most controversial opinion that Stevens wrote in his long tenure, and he came under a lot of fire for writing this, and Reason Magazine certainly was after him quite a bit for it. And so in 2011, after he retired from the Supreme Court, he gave a speech at the University of Alabama Law School where he addressed some of these criticisms, because he had not addressed the critics before. He wrote a memoir that came out that year, and he didn't talk, Kelo is not mentioned in the memoir. He talks about other cases he's involved in, but he doesn't even address this case because he thought it was, you know, an open shut win for the government. And so at this speech, Stevens said, Kelo was, quote, rooted in Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes's broad reading of the text of the Constitution. He went on, Kelo, quote, adhered to the doctrine of judicial restraint, which allows state legislatures broad latitude in making economic policy decisions in their respective jurisdictions. So there's the ghost of Oliver Wendell Holmes, you know, dead a century, still haunting these decisions. And, you know, I think it's safe to say that judicial deference in that case failed failed these property owners, but it failed the Constitution also. And it serves as an example of these two philosophies in action. Does the Constitution require the courts to defend liberty and to really look at what the government is doing? It doesn't mean you overturn every government action, but you really look at what's going on rather than just say, well, we're going to leave it to the lawmakers to decide if it's a public use, and we're going to trust them. We're going to put the thumb on the scale on the government side, rather than look at is there pretextual reasons? Is there something else going on here? And that really is, you know, the libertarian view is that's the role of the courts. That's the court's job. You know, John Roberts in Obamacare said, it's not our job to protect the people from the consequences of their political choices. And the libertarian view is it is your job to protect the people from the consequences of their political choices when those choices violate the Constitution. 51% of the voters don't, just a pure majority does not make an unconstitutional action permissible. So that's the libertarian legal view. In my book, as I said, traces this debate and looks at this and focuses on the libertarian work that's been done. And I'll just conclude now by saying that, you know, what this debate really is a fundamental question about the nature of our system, and it sort of asks us a fundamental question of, you know, what sort of system, what constitutional system do we want to have, do we want to live under? You know, should the Supreme Court defer to the will of the majority and respect the will of the majority and therefore uphold most democratically enacted laws? Or does the Constitution empower the courts to act as a check on the other branches of government and then to act and act aggressively and act in even an anti-democratic fashion when the majority has overstepped its boundaries? And so I think that we can look at the history of the Supreme Court and we can see this debate coming up time and time again. It's present in our current debates. The Obamacare was heard at the Supreme Court last week. I was there for that. I'm sure people have questions about that, so I won't talk any more about it. This is a really fundamental debate, and it helps us understand what the court has been up to in the past, but also helps us understand what's coming down the line. And I think it's really essential to understanding this third branch of our government. And they may be politicians, but they have a lot of power, and these ideas matter. We're all good. Thank you all very much. Really enjoyed it.